then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's December the 18th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, all kinds of housekeeping notes to start off with this week. First off, in a way, I'm happy to report that we're getting so slammed with initial contacts and requests for introductory packets that we have once again run out of white books. I did reorder a couple of weeks ago when I saw this coming, but we were unable to afford the extra $60 or so for expedited shipping, and so the next case lot of white books is at present wending its way toward me slowly across the country in a big brown truck from the eastern seaboard via UPS Slowboat. So, all you new guys out there who are listening to the podcast, who are eagerly awaiting your first contact with the Northwest Front, it may take me a few days to get you your intro packs. In a pinch, I can send you a copy of the white book in PDF format, if you don't mind reading it on your computer screen, but I really prefer to send you an actual book that you can hold in your hand. Something real and tangible. It makes it seem like we have some kind of existence in the real world and not just on a computer screen. Now, secondly, remember a couple of months or so ago when I was bitching and moaning about our running out of certain NF foldover brochures? One comrade in Idaho and another comrade in Florida have now stepped forward and done some hand printing of these foldover brochures on their personal printers, and I now have a small supply of both of these handheld items on hand. Now, if any of you folks out there will absolutely swear to me that you will get these brochures out into the general population, not just pass them around in our own little incestuous circles, but actually get these items into the hands of muggles, white people who are not already racially conscious, white people to whom this is probably the first item of overtly racist literature they'll ever hold in their hands, now then I can send you some copies in batches of about 20 each. These are excellent first contact pieces, and that's what they need to be used for. We do not have enough to fill orders for hundreds or thousands of copies, unfortunately. That'll come when we get an adequately staffed and adequately funded professionalized party. Obviously, you can't do a mass distribution with 20 copies. These brochures would be good for anonymous mailing to people who might seem to be likely prospects to you, like that one comrade did in the South Carolina and thereby got us some regional media publicity. Do not waste these brochures by mailing them to niggers or to the local synagogue. Never waste any white nationalist literature in playing pranks on niggers. That's not what it's for. The purpose of NF literature is not to play pranks on niggers. It is to educate and convert our own people. We have nothing to say to blacks, Jews, or Democrats. Let me hear from you if you want some of these. Now, while I'm on the subject, what with the increase in inquiries, we are also running out of back issues of the Northwest Observer. And since I now have several standing bulk orders for our little magazine or journal, I'm going to have to increase the monthly press run of the publication. For real, comrades, the subscription rate has been rising, and the intro pack request rate has been rising, and general demand for the Northwest Observer has been rising to the point where I have to print more of them every month. I keep telling you guys, it's happening. Way too slowly, but it's happening. Oh, one last thing. Several months ago, the post office stopped issuing the $1 stamp, which truly pisses me off because I actually use almost as many of those as I do forever stamps. Any chance any of you could see if your local post offices have any $1 stamps left and buy them up and send them on to me if so? Now, I consider contributions in postage stamps to be just as good as cash since so much of our cash goes for postage. Now, on to the biggest NF housekeeping story for some weeks. This is kind of a historic moment. On December the 12th, the Northwest Front received its first coverage in a serious, if not quite mainstream, publication. I'm talking about an actual newsstand-type glossy magazine entitled The Counterterrorism Journal of something called the International Association of Counterterrorism and Security Professionals. I looked them up online, and apparently they're some kind of neoconservative think tank founded in the 1990s with what one article refers to as, quote-unquote, close ties to Israel. So I think we know what's going on here. Can you say front for the Mossad? Sure you can. Either that or it's someone trying to run a Mike Brown Soldier of Fortune-style money-making racket off so-called terrorism, and why not? There's a lot of that out there. It's to be expected. There are big, big bucks in the terrorism industry ever since 9/11, and the little fish are going to gather to feed off the vast drool from the maw of the multi-billion dollar federal terrorism budget. At any rate, this thingy is the real deal. A nice, printed magazine on glossy paper and good graphic artwork. Actually had a decent photograph of me, not that usual piece of crap they publish with me from 1980 wearing the bilious green-white power t-shirt and the golf cap. And it's actually available for purchase at newsstands and in bookstore magazine sections like Barnes & Noble, so it's not just one of our own incestuous little photocopied circle jerk newsletters where we interview each other for an audience of 42 people. All middle-aged men with big bellies, like me, for example. With some effort, I obtained a PDF copy of the text, and I've been considering republishing the article verbatim in Northwest Observer, but I decided against it. If these guys really are some kind of front for the Likud, then they are the kind of assholes who would scream and holler and send nasty lawyers' letters about their precious copyright being violated by an obnoxious and heretical white boy like me, so I won't be republishing it in print or online. I will be running a few private print copies off to pass around to those of you who want to read it, but who can't find a copy on your newsstand and don't want to get your name on the list of what may be a Mossad or other Israeli NGO. And if they want to scream and holler and threaten to sue me, well, it won't be the first time. Now, you can read the magazine online, but what you're seeing there is a screenshot of the printed page. I found it very hard to navigate. I probably will not be sending out any of the PDF copies online for the reasons stated above, and since on the internet certain words like discretion and confidential seem to lose their meanings, and stuff I send out has a tendency to end up in places where it shouldn't be, let's give it a few months anyway and see how this plays out. Now, one thing I do want to mention for those of you who either read this online or in one of my privately circulated PDF copies. There is a lot of personal drivel in there about me in the first part of the article, the kind of crap which is untrue without being outright false, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, the kind of horse manure that the media specializes in. They very seldom outright lie, since they might get caught, and they know that they need to maintain at least some shred of credibility. But they nonetheless convey untruth, if you get my drift. Now, some of you have asked me in the past what the term goat dancing means. Well, this is it. Vicious and false, slanderous attacks against me personally, what are known as ad hominem attacks, which are of no conceivable relevance to the subject under discussion and which are there to try to distract people from what I'm actually saying. I'm not going to bother to try and refute this drivel. I will simply say this to you, that from now on, as we get more and more of this kind of system publicity, we are going to have to accept that this very silly official narrative about my past life is going to become a recurring leitmotif running in the background of everything we do. The media is going to regurgitate and regurgitate and re-regurgitate a number of silly and untrue stories about me from the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. And since we can't deal with this kind of behavior as it should be dealt with, then there's nothing we can do about it, and we're simply going to have to accept it as normal background noise and disregard it. And remember what I said to that pagan lady a few weeks ago? One of the hardest things for someone to do in this day and age is to simply ignore it when someone is screaming their hatred of you on the internet, something I have a lot of experience doing, but which I admit that I myself have difficulty with still. All that having been said, in fairness to Dr. George Michael, the author of the article, in view of who he was writing for and who was signing the checks, I think he had to put the gibberish in there, or the article simply would never have seen the light of day. Now, I have dealt with Dr. Michael since 2008 on one thing and another, He probably considers me to be pond scum, but he's never been so impolite as to let it show, and that's more than I can say about most reporters I've dealt with. Simple courtesy costs nothing, which is a lesson most mainstream journalists never seem to learn. Now, he and I both know the rules, and I have to say that once you get past the politically required initial smokescreen of Gubu, the article in Counterterrorism Journal is not too bad at all. It's kind of an, okay, I've genuflected before the altar of liberalism and bashed and insulted my subject up to the required minimum standard, so the publication won't get you in trouble with the Jews who are signing you guys checks. Now, can I get on with what I have to say? That kind of thing. Once he lays the Gubu aside, Dr. Michael quite frankly presents the Northwest Imperative as fairly and completely as we're probably ever going to get with this media. Like I mentioned, I found it kind of hard to read online because you can't actually access a proper text. It's just a screenshot of the paper page, and it's hard to navigate, but it's worth putting up with the jiggling screen and the reading. Now, I'll get that PDF copy run off soon, and I'll start circulating it. But again, people, we have another sign here. It's starting to happen.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels rolling. Are we going to do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run the base.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Arizona. I just left Kingman on my way up to deliver my load of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. And I've been catching up on back episodes of Radio Free Northwest as I'm driving. I'm currently working through the spring of 12. And I really think that Harold needs to go and put a disclaimer on some of these podcast that he puts out, because I almost wrecked my brand spanking new 2015 truck when Dry Eyes' wife came on the diversity that he's required to put on his podcast every once in a while. Damn, I'm laughing all so hard I almost wrecked the truck. Anyway, onto a more serious note, I keep hearing this over and over and over again. Harold requesting everyone to move up here to the Northwest. I really don't understand why you're not here yet. I mean, it's a nice area. Yeah, it rains a little bit, but come on. I mean, I've been up here since January of 80. Did a short stint, 86, down in Oregon for about a year and a half while I was in the Navy and stuff, then back up to the Puget Sound area to the sub-base Banger. And I've had my house since, 88 and stuff, so yeah, it's a nice area. I don't understand why you don't want to come up this neck of the woods. If you want drier weather, well, you can move over to the other side of the mountains, to the eastern side of Washington or Oregon, where it's more desertish and stuff, but it's also a colder climate over there. And if you really like colder climates and stuff, northern Idaho, western Montana, yeah, they work good. The area just east of Lincoln, Montana, they have the big sign out there, coldest recorded temperature in the North American continent at 70 below zero, I believe it was, near that site. Yeah, I'm on. Waiting to see them moving vans out there. The price of fuel's down, so it'd be a little bit cheaper for you to go and head this way now. So, let's get in gear, guys. Come on. We're waiting. There's housing available here. They're always building new apartments and houses out here. I'm driving right now, so that's what all the background noise is the truck going, heading north on U.S. 93, getting ready to go over top of the Hoover Dam and now have a nice bypass where we don't have to go down through Bullhead City to get to Vegas from Kingman, which is a long pull coming up out of the Colorado River Gorge there. But anyway, I don't mind hitting this neck of the woods during this time of the year and stuff, but it gets a little warm for my likings at 110, 120 degrees. Yeah, I don't like stepping out on the pavement and having the heat come through the soles of my shoes. Yeah, not good. No, don't like that. The trucker doggy doesn't like it either. Boy, he goes and he tries to get all four paws off the ground at the same time. He loves it up there in the Northwest, though. Yep. He enjoys the snow and stuff, the occasions we get it there, but he gets to see a lot of it going across Montana and North Dakota and upstate New York, where I just went through. There, you got a lot of snow up there, too, but Puget Sound area, and doesn't get a whole lot of snow there, so if you want snow, you can go up to the mountains, though, and play and ski and snowmobile and hike through it and enjoy yourself. Yep. Being born and raised in Michigan, about an hour north of Detroit, I do not miss the jungle drums. And don't have a whole lot of salsa music there in the going on in the Puget Sound area either. Might get a little bit more of it over there on the eastern side of the Cascades and stuff, where they have a lot of the migrant workers. And we're fairly free of it there in the Puget Sound area. We just have to put up with all the liberals and the like. And we do have our share of niggers running around. And you want to stay away from some of the areas around Tacoma and Seattle. And I'm sure Portland has their areas also. I'm not all familiar with the Portland area. Didn't spend a whole lot of time there other than just delivering and stuff. And we do have our transients up here too, under the bridge people and stuff, but this time of year they tend to migrate to warmer climates. All right, this is the trucker signing off for yet another segment of Tidbits on the Road. Hope to see you up in the homeland soon, comrades.
Hey guys, Andy Donner here to introduce the next musical number. About a week ago, I noticed a few Ebola items in the news. Some countries in Africa have it dealt with, and others are struggling to keep up after this past season's outbreak. In other words, it's still an ongoing event. Right about the same time, I ran across a parody of Take Me Home Country Roads called Take My Hand Ebola Chan. Problem is that it's not funny unless you know who Ebola Chan is. Ebola Chan is a cartoon character designed to be an anthropomorphic representation of the Ebola virus. For those of you who attended American public schools in the last couple of decades, that means Ebola Chan is a human version of Ebola, which was created to allow us to relate to Ebola on a human level. For reasons I don't totally understand, this character went viral, pun intended, on Pol, the politically incorrect section of 4chan. Pol is known for its white nationalist bent, and while the image was initially spread as a humorous threat of Ebola, at some point, someone got the idea of deifying Ebola Chan and thanking Ebola for killing niggers, which I suppose it does well enough. After that, the meme took on a completely racist meaning, and the racist internet had a field day with it for a few months. Eventually, white nationalists all over the world were cheering Ebola on in the form of Ebola Chan because of the nigger death toll. With all that said, here's some guy on YouTube with Take My Hand Ebola Chan. We love you, Ebola Chan. Good luck.
Took a plane ride with Ebola. Flew to Dallas, caused another show. Thomas Duncan, she loved him till he died. There's no cure for love when you're bleeding from the eyes. Take my hand. Now spread your wings, girl, the whole earth is calling. The happening of happenings is truly on the way. Faith on earth is generous in their own blood and purge them all away.
Evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing Rockwell's This Time the World. One of the first things that Rockwell tells us in this book is that he really has no time for modesty, because modesty is either a necessity or it's a disgusting lie. And while he doesn't want to be a self-aggrandizer, he feels that it's paramount that National Socialism rises to power. So he wants to tell us, how did he get to this point? And he goes somewhat into his early life. He obviously had a certain amount of love and admiration for his father. And he's really glad that his father was creative and always encouraged independent thought. But Rockwell was much more serious-minded than his father. He sometimes tires of his father, who always tends to see life as a comedy. It's evident that Rockwell prefers independent study to schoolwork. He likes to read, but he's very concerned about novels that put emotion before reason. And at a relatively young age, he starts to question Christianity. First, he becomes an atheist. But then he realizes that religion is a necessity for most, and he begins to have some respect for religion. He ends up going to Brown, and he has conflicts, especially with sociology professors, because Rockwell is really more of a determinist than an environmentalist in terms of how people turn out and whether environment or other factors such as genetics plays a role. Rockwell has a certain misanthropic tendency, and he's even more convinced of this when he sees that the majority of the people elect Roosevelt. Despite all of this skepticism that he has, he's still influenced by Hollywood. He ends up being influenced by all the anti-Hitler propaganda, and particularly by a film starring Charlie Chaplin. So even though he has all of this discernment, even if he can't name it, he is taken in by Chaplin really because of the vaudeville connection, because his father was a vaudevillian, and he's taken in by that style of humor. So Rockwell decides to go into the military. He talks with the president of Brown University, and the president says, "You know, Rockwell, you can't be a great man unless you finish college." Rockwell's response was, "Well, if the U.S. is destroyed, then what's the point of my being a great man?" So at that time, a very kind of conventional nationalistic patriotism. He loves the military, but he's frequently disappointed by the appointments that he gets. He goes into the Navy. At that time, the Navy was also in charge of flight, and he always wants more aggressive assignments. Now, Rockwell enters into his first marriage rather hastily, but finds that his first wife is very ill-prepared for marriage and talks about how he feels that women should have degrees in home economics before marriage. After World War II is over, Rockwell attempts to become a commercial artist. This is the first of a whole series of commercial ventures for Rockwell, which often prove to be a disappointment for all sorts of reasons, often because he has to work with other people and there's often a chafing under the direction of others. Sometimes people don't have the same vision that he has. Eventually, around the time the Korean War is breaking out, he becomes very interested in McCarthy. He reads the Protocols of Zion, and he decides that even if they are fake, they were written by a genius. And he reads Mein Kampf, and he's appalled by his past ignorance. At around this time, his first marriage just falls apart. However, this first marriage will continue to plague him because he'll have alimony payments. So he ends up meeting someone else when he's assigned to a post in Iceland. And at around this time, he decides he's going to publish a black ops magazine called The U.S. Lady, which was supposed to have all these hidden, in a way, messages or black ops having to do with race mixing, that he was going to make it so disgustingly pro-race mixing that it would actually have the reverse effect. But like so many other projects, this project becomes commandeered by others. He has to work with a lot of creative types. Eventually, there's even a communist that he runs into that wants to publish a companion magazine called U.S. Officer. Rockwell still is at a stage of working within the system. Of course, this was a different time. So he ends up informing the FBI about that because he wants to turn in all these communists. Now, he starts to get involved with all these conservatives and some that are kind of beyond conservative. He gets somewhat involved with John Casper and even gets to meet Ezra Pound. But he says that a lot of people know the problem, but they can't state the problem. And he's more and more desperate to get the word out. Again, he tries to become a script writer, but again, there's just these problems with other people that are really not fully embracing his message. And then he tries to get involved in another magazine that he's trying to publish. He tries to bring various people together, and they always seem to fall short, even when they're millionaires. They're always backing out at the last minute. He says that people really need to lose their precious jobs and reputation. And he says that a magazine like Mercury is similar to writing a representative in Congress all of the time. Now, at this point, he's desperate for money. He has two families to support. He gets involved in sales. He works in New York and also Pennsylvania, and he sees the Jewish money control, and he becomes even more radical. He writes a newsletter called Battle Cry and goes to speak in Tennessee at a conference. There, he suggests a black repatriation plan. This plan is going to cost, at that time, about $50 million. They're going to develop a territory in Africa for blacks. At this point, he's having to move a lot for his job, so he gives up his home. He decides he's going to move with his family into a trailer, and it's not because he has no other options, and it's just that he needs to move around a lot. He's always getting all these different jobs. Now, this isn't easy on his wife. Her family starts begging her to go back to Iceland. Rockwell, at this point, he wants to be open about his views, but he wants to keep it legal. And to him, at this stage, now, of course, he's writing this in the 60s, the police and the FBI are not the enemy to Rockwell. He doesn't run from them because he knows if he runs, they're going to chase him. Instead, he tells them what he's doing. And more, he gets more radical and more religious and starts to see Hitler as a great conqueror of human misery. He works with black Muslims because he wants to encourage this whole Back to Africa movement. But he starts to run afoul of the law. His office gets raided and he has to go to court. Now, at this point, a lot of his stormtroopers quit and his marriage is really falling apart. Both his wife and her family say, Rockwell, you've got to get out of this politics or else the marriage is over. And he tries to save his marriage, but he can't abandon his calling. And he stops believing in the promises that other people make. Now, his marriage ends despite heroic efforts, despite going to Iceland to try to reunite with his wife. But at this point, Rockwell is liberated, really, from many earthly responsibilities. As might be inevitable, eventually he also has to try to fight for his position within the Navy. Even though he argues to stay in the Navy, ends up being released from the service, and he really has to rebuild his organization. At one point, he's ordered to have a psychological evaluation and is forced to go to an asylum. So here's a man who's losing absolutely everything for the cause, whatever his faults may be. He talks about those who are forced into this type of imprisonment to play nicely with the doctors. Don't fight. If you're going to fight something, fight the laws. He talks about how the modern world is a mutiny of inferiors against the elite and how we must apply science to human betterment. Now, at the end of the day, it's just as well that he lost his Navy position because he realizes that National Socialism doesn't recognize national boundaries as important. It's not for capitalism or communism, and it doesn't destroy any race. It will also not become treasonous against the laws of nature. He says something that I don't know if I quite agree with. He says that you don't always have to be dignified and reasonable because people are emotional. Now, as far as people being emotional, of course, our Führer says the equivalent in Mein Kampf about how the mass of humanity has a feminine nature of emotionalism. So he wants the National Socialists to be in all-out opposition to what people hate. And he says that being seen as evil really doesn't matter. He says that whites are going to get fed up in 8 or 9 years. Now, of course, again, he's writing this in 1960. He says the masses like things simple, and the National Socialists are going to be standing against what the masses hate. And he talks about how his book is going to help with propaganda and they're going to educate people. They're going to run for office. And he says that the rich conservatives are going to see the truth and they're going to help the party. And whites are going to see that Republicans and Democrats are a useless division. And when they see the National Socialists and they're going to solve the Negro problem because they're going to send them all back to Africa, and all kinds of white people are going to join the National Socialists because it doesn't matter what religion you are. By 1973, Rockwell figures he's going to be president of the United States. Now, of course, none of this happened, and one has to ask, do whites really deserve to live? They reject National Socialism again and again. It's certainly been around for some time, not an entirely new idea. So I've developed from reading this book a new appreciation of Rockwell because really, while he may not have been perfect, he did give everything up to the cause. And so at some point I may read some other books by Rockwell. So here was somebody who thought that the balloon was going to go up any minute. And, of course, didn't. At any rate, one wonders how much longer this kind of thing is going to go on. So, good evening, and thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
And here's a brief clip from one of our Canadian comrades. And I'm really glad that we finally heard from one of our people up there in the Great White North. Considering the hate laws and the human rights tribunals and whatnot that they have to put up with, I really would like to see some of our Canadian people take more advantage of Radio Free Northwest and the free speech accorded to people here in the United States than they do. So any of you Canadians up there who want to have your say, please, you know, send me an MP3 file.
Hello, comrades. Canadian Nationalist here. It has been said that the Northwest American Republic will be based upon the traditional nuclear family. A father at the head with a woman at his side and the children underneath them, as is stated in our Constitution. But why is this? It is not simply to roll back the clock to the 1950s and return to the golden age of apple pie and all-American television. It instead goes much, much deeper. Aristotle said that there is no distinction between the household and the state. This statement is true. Any nation is built upon the foundations of the family unit. Without a healthy family unit, the nation itself will become sick, wither, and eventually die, much as we are observing in the current United States and the rest of Western civilization. Aristotle also stated that the family is the bare bones of the nation. Every nation had its beginnings as a village, and the village was simply a colony of those of the family, composed of children and grandchildren. The family was ruled by the eldest, whose word was usually law. Through that, the monarchist system of government was born. So, one can observe that the family unit is much more important than we usually take it at face value. It shapes the very politics of the nation at its heart. The Romans during the Republic knew that a family with a patriarch at its head would indeed lead to a stable family and would equal a strong nation. The Romans had laws based around the idea of the family with a father at its head, to which the father was the central key figure of the family unit, where he would micromanage the lives of his sons until age 20, or somewhere around there, I forget the exact age, and his daughters until they marry. The intellectuals who constructed the Napoleonic Code knew the power of a stable family as well, and originally made it central to the Napoleonic Code, where the father played a very large role in the family, similar to that under the Roman Republic. A nation cannot be strong and remain strong without a strong family. And thus, if the Northwest American Republic is to be strong, it must be sure to keep the idea of the nuclear family as close to its tenets as possible. Similar to how we cannot build a skyscraper upon the foundations of sand, neither can a nation be built upon the series of dysfunctional, disunited families. The Northwest Republic prevails, comrades.
Okay, this is a new one from our British songwriter and singer, Arland Bran. It's a very Scandinavian black metal type of sound, kind of like Wardruna. Oddly enough, before this came in, I was going to play some Wardruna this week, since I just finished watching the second season of The Vikings, and got all inspired. This is called The Blood of Kvasir. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today, I'm going to talk about porn. No. Not that porn. I mean bad news porn. I need to get in my last jab at the audience, after all. I don't really have a whole lot to say on this one, so I'll keep it short. The political right has always had an odd obsession with passing around bad news stories to each other for some purpose I cannot discern. This has been a decades-old phenomenon, and yet the white race doesn't seem to be any better off. Nevertheless, it seems circulating news clippings, be they paper or electronic, of the awful, awful things done to white people the world over, gets most of you overly excited. So I'll refer to it as bad news porn. My main complaint isn't so much that this bad news exchange is taking place. Rather, there's so much of it that everyone who does so on a regular basis pretty clearly spends all of their time on nothing else. A person would make better use of their waking hours to elect any other activity. Let me again remind you, the barriers to my own migration were not removed by Herculean efforts, but by small amounts of time invested on a daily basis. I think all of you bad news pornographers out there could sacrifice a few minutes from your busy news reading schedules, don't you? But, of course, that's not going to happen. Despite a success rate of exactly 0%, the only possible reason for passing around bad news, of which the rest of the white nationalist movement is perfectly well aware, is that these bad news pornographers among us think exposure to these news stories will spur action on the part of others. Surely, after all the years this strategy has been in use, we would know better. Waiting for other people to solve your problems for you is never the right thing to do. Further, there's always the obvious contradiction in expecting others to be motivated by bad news you purvey when you yourself admit, even begrudgingly, that you don't care enough to do whatever it is you expect from others. Put more plainly, if your bad news porn were so motivational, why haven't you yourself been influenced by it? As with some other issues I've had to call white nationalism out on, I myself was guilty of this, but only very briefly. About 2 weeks after I initially found the Northwest Front, media spick Rick Sanchez managed to get himself canned because he started talking about Jews and their propensity for amazing promotion paths in the news industry. Like quite a few people before me, I saw this item on the Drudge Report, read it, and immediately dispatched an email to Herald. I'm not really sure what I expected, but I do know I was certain of my critical responsibility to our white race to make sure Herald, and through him, the entire radio-free Northwest audience, heard about Rick Sanchez in all his spickdom. I half anticipated an electronic pat on the head from Herald for my great efforts for our race, and in every respect, I was completely wrong. Firstly, and to be sure, most importantly, no matter how I and many, many others felt about it at the time, Rick Sanchez's firing didn't matter one iota to the racial struggle. Getting excited about it was a complete and total waste of time and effort. How many of the bad news items passed around the internet by quite a few of you are of no import? Nearly all, I would imagine. Secondly, even if this were of some significance, which it wasn't, it was a national news item. I and the dozens of other people who saw fit to do so had no business sending an email blast to someone who likely saw the news before they checked their email. The email itself served no purpose. Thirdly, the attitude which causes a person to miscalculate the value of the news and the email itself also causes said person to expect a grateful reply. In reality, Harold had no reason to appreciate the emails the rest of the internet and I sent him. In fact, going through all of them was certainly a drain on his time because a bunch of us couldn't find anything better to do. And on that note, the party has to periodically remind people we don't mean anything by not dropping everything and replying to your emails, particularly when they're bad news porn. And even when they're not, remember this. There are other people in the world, and you're not the only one who thinks they need our attention. Strictly speaking, none of you is entitled to an email response. And more to the point, it's by no means an insult when you aren't responded to. Oddly enough, most of the bad news porn sent around the web is one instance or another of some nigger killing a white girl. Quite regularly, we're asked what the party thinks of that. Do you really need an email exchange to figure out what we think of such a thing? Hail victory, comrades.
Got an email after last week's podcast from Jim in Los Angeles referring to my comments on the goings-on in Ferguson, Missouri, and my appeal to white cops to think about what the hell they're doing before they support a third-world tyrant. Jim says basically, "Hey, Harold, whose side are you on? I thought you hated cops." Okay, looks like I need to go over this again. Now, this is, in fact, a complex subject, and I need to make it clear because this is one of the more important of the topics that I am going to be addressing. Now, my attitude towards white law enforcement officers is complicated because their situation is complicated. First off, there is a very distinct difference between real law enforcement officers and federal agents. Not the same breed at all. Real cops are, well, actual cops and detectives and whatnot. They mostly prevent and detect actual real crimes, which are actually committed by real people of all races. Federal agents do the will of their politically appointed superiors in the United States government in exchange for money and benefits, and believe me, there is a world of difference. Now, most of the so-called crimes that federal agents allegedly deal with weren't even crimes 100 years ago, and in more and more cases, the evidence in these so-called crimes is simply made up, fabricated for political purposes. Edgar Steele, Matt Hale, and Bill White are just three of the best-known examples. Now, in some cases, federal agents carry out what are known under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011 as extrajudicial executions, although they were doing them as far back as 1987, to my knowledge, when feds whacked those faggots who were blackmailing prominent Democrats in the Shelby Bookstore case back in North Carolina, which they then tried to pin on to white Patriot Party members but could never make stick. And I'm rambling again, but anyway, the history of the FBI and these other federal agencies of doing this kind of thing certainly did not begin with Ruby Ridge or Waco. So federal agents are basically just goons for the dictator. They're not real cops, and last week I was referring to actual cops. But even among them, we need to differentiate between for real street cops and correctional officers who go to work every day and physically confront and deal with the behavior of niggers and beaners and the other fruits of diversity, and the politicized cops at roughly sergeant level and above who spend their entire shift shuffling papers and doing meetings and schmoozing in the break room back at the precinct house. I knew an NYPD officer once who told me flat out, "Do not trust any police officer in any force of the rank of sergeant or above, because that is where the politics sets in, and that's the point where an officer who may have been a brave and perfectly squared away street cop up to that point has to start demonstrating that he or she is a quote-unquote team player." In other words, they have to show political reliability, which is, of course, common in all police and military forces in third world countries like the United States. Now, that having been said, the lefty liberals really do have one thing right. America's white street cops are probably one of the last preserves of plain and simple good old-fashioned racism around. Yeah, they're all racists, because they have to be. Cops and correctional officers deal with the realities of race in a way that no one else in this society is forced to. Everyone else, almost, can run away from racial reality. Cops and prison guards can't, because they are the garbage men who are expected to keep the streets clean and at least sufficiently safe to maintain the pretense that everything is fine and still working, and of course to protect the welfare and happiness of wealthy liberal Democrats and keep them safe in their gated communities and carefully isolated techie and university latte towns, of which San Francisco is now pretty much the largest. Liberalism and diversity and multiculturalism and tolerance are luxuries that real cops and correctional officers can't afford, because they're not real. And if street cops and correctional officers allow themselves to get sucked up in a liberal fantasy that's not real, they die. Keeping it real about race is something that real cops have to do as a survival mechanism. They know who the really dangerous people are out there. They know who sells the drugs. They know who's doing the B&Es and the carjackings. They know who are committing the racially motivated hate crimes and who the victims are. Now these men and women are being thrown under the bus by the same people who have been signing their paychecks for so long. And these same people who have been signing their paychecks are buckling under the Democrat pressure to make it almost impossible for the real cops to do their jobs. They're putting body cameras on them and forcing them into so-called sensitivity training and basically imposing racial quotas as to who they can stop and frisk. How many white cops have already died, do you figure, because they were too slow to draw their weapons on some 6'5", 300-pound nigger charging down on them in a homicidal or drugged-up rage for fear of a lawsuit and for fear of having Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton screaming on their doorstep? For fear of getting the Darren Wilson treatment and being forced into hiding with their families for doing their duty? And so they hesitated, and they drew their pistol a few seconds too late, and the huge charging nigger was on them, and this time they weren't as lucky as Wilson was when he was able to fight off the gentle giant and plug his black ass. Now, has that happened already? Probably. If not, it will happen soon. How many cops have lost their jobs and their careers and had their lives ruined because they did their duty? And for the record, yes, I understand that a lot of those white cops are just in it for the money, and they would beat us and shoot us and frame us with perjured testimony just as quickly as they would niggers, the more so because we have white skin and we're fair game. We can't fight back, or rather we won't, and they know it. And that's where it gets complicated. Now, I say again, cops and serving members of the military are absolutely central to the continued existence of this vile system. Their guns and their bayonets keep the dictatorship in power. We have to try and reach out to those of our racial brothers with the badges who can be reached. Not all of them, but those who aren't completely lost yet. Just because a man puts on a badge or a uniform doesn't necessarily mean he changes his skin. Now, speaking of law and order and justice, here is a song about immigration control back in the old days. This is Tom Russell.
Two men rode in from the south, a rainy autumn night, the sky above and the mud below. They walked into the deacon's bar, they were Mexican by sight, the sky above and the mud below. They threw a horsehair bridle down, we trade this for whiskey rounds. The deacon slams a bottle down, the two men start to drink it. Their hair was long and black, tied up behind their ears, the sky above and the mud below. Their faces were identical, like one man beside a mirror, the sky above and the mud below. Then someone whispers, that beats all their wanted posters on the wall. Twin brothers, name a Sandoval, horse face from Boquias. Now the bridle and the belts they wore, braided gray and black, the sky above and the mud below. The color of her own horse once belonged to Deacon Black, the sky above and the mud below. The fastest horse for miles around, he'd been stolen from the old fairground. A month ago outside of town, we tracked and never found him. Now the deacon was a preacher who'd fallen hard from grace, the sky above and the mud below. He owned a bar and a string of quarter horses that he'd race, the sky above and the mud below. Yet deacon, he could drink and curse, though he still quoted sacred verse. He was sheriff, judge, he owned the hearse, a man you did not anger. The sky above, the mud below, the wind and rain, the sleet and snow. Two horse thieves from Mexico, drinking hard and singing. One brother, he spoke English, deacon choirs as to their work, the sky above and the mud below. The man says, Mister, we braid horsehair, bridles, ropes, and quirts, the sky above and the mud below. Yeah, that fine bridle we did make, a roan horse killed by a leg bone break. He's horsehair rope now, horse meat steak. We cleaned him to the bone. Well, these gentlemen, they were ignorant, or didn't know just where they were, the sky above and the mud below. The deacon's face grew darker as he measured every word, the sky above and the mud below. You horsehair braiding sons of bitches stole my claimed earthly riches. Someone go and dig a ditch, there may well be a hanging. One brother reached inside his shirt, a searching for his gun, the sky above and the mud below. Too late for Deke had whipped around his sawed-off Remington, the sky above and the mud below. The twins, they raised their hands and sneered. Deke was grinning ear to ear. He says, court's in session, hear ye, hear, yours truly is presiding. Well, the trial commenced and ended quick. They didn't have a hope, the sky above and the mud below. Deke says, we'll cut your hair now, boys, and you can braid yourselves a rope, the sky above and the mud below. The Old Testament, it says somewhere, eye for eye and hair for hair, covet not thy neighbor's mare. I believe it's Revelation. Now the fancy horsehair bridle, it hangs on Deacon's wall, the sky above and the mud below. Next to that wanted poster of the brothers Sandoval, the sky above and the mud below. And the twisted rope so shiny black, the artifact that broke their necks, their craftsmanship he did respect, they should have stuck to braid. The sky above, the mud below, the wind and rain, the sleet and snow, the deacon's hearse is rolling slow in the first blue light of morning.
Okay, this is the last actual Radio Free Northwest as such for the Annus Horribilis of 2014. Next week, the official date of the podcast will be Christmas Day, December 25th, and normally I'd have Christmas music on here, but since that will be the last podcast for the calendar year of 2014, we'll be doing our annual All Music year-end Radio Free Northwest instead of a Christmas program as such, and that's good. The last thing most of you need by December 25th is more Christmas crap. Now, before I sign off, I want to say a few things. The first is that at the risk of deliberately sounding mysterious and dropping portentous hints and sounding like I'm trying to intrigue you or lead you on, it is a simple fact that this year, for the first time, there have been and remain certain things that I cannot talk to you about. Mostly good things. That's rare. Because before this, I was a completely open book, and anything the dictator's servants wanted to know about me, they could find out via my published statements and writings or else by hacking my computer, which I'm sure they do with regularity as a matter of routine. Now, I won't be coy anymore. I'll just assure all of you once again that things are in fact moving forward. They're just moving entirely too slow to be of any practical use if the balloon goes up anytime soon. Now, I know this sounds ironic, but at the rate we're going, we'd better hope the dictatorship lasts for a while, because we need a lot more time to get our act together, although I do promise you that process has finally begun. Secondly, I want to apologize to some of you folks out there whom I won't name and who in some cases I probably can't remember. Every week, sometimes almost every day, I receive long, deep, insightful letters and emails from you folks out there, mostly from middle-aged and elderly men like myself, who have been screwed by America and to whom I can relate, because unfortunately that demographic comprises at least a bare majority of our active supporters. It's only natural that the people who have been the most badly oppressed and violated by a tyrannical regime will comprise the majority of those responding to revolutionary tendencies. But I also receive the same kind of letters and emails, long and deep and insightful and full of ideas worth discussing and thinking about, from more and more young men, including teenagers and high school students, and even some from women. Yes, there is finally some indication that white women are beginning to understand what is being done to them by this society, and that they have no future here without their men at their sides. Some of these are letters and emails wherein someone literally pours out their soul to me because they've been so blown away and transfigured by finding us on the internet or reading a Northwest novel and realizing for the first time that there are others like themselves, that no, they're not crazy, that other white people really do see and understand and feel the same things that they do. These long and personal letters and emails are things that some of you have taken a long time to compose and write out, in some cases the first time in years that you have dared to set pen to paper or finger to keyboard and say these things out loud. Now, I consider it a privilege to receive these communications and an honor to be considered worthy of such personal and difficult revelations, especially when it is clear that someone has quite literally never dared to speak, write, or otherwise articulate any racial or political thought, ever. Most heartbreaking of all are the letters from prisoners. I don't publish most of what I get from Bill White. It's simply too depressing to watch that brilliant mind suffer under the torture he's being subjected to by his pin-headed captors. And it's just so hard to blow you guys off. But the fact is that in the majority of cases over the past year, that's what I've been doing, and for that I deeply and profoundly apologize. You come to me begging and pleading for my attention, and I have to ration it out to you like water on a lifeboat. Now let me explain what life is like for me. I'm sure some of you wonder just what it is I do with myself all day in exchange for all the big bucks you pay me. Well, I'll tell you. I repeat, this is not an excuse. It is an explanation, and you need to understand the difference. Now, I've been called, among other things, a leader, a spokesman, a spiritual guide, or simply a writer. I'm none of those things. I am a secretary. The overwhelming majority of my day is spent doing the dozens of small little daily jobs that have to be done by somebody in order to maintain even the barest pretense that the Northwest Front is an actual group or movement. I can't see the forest for all the trees. Intro packets must be assembled and mailed out, especially lately when we're getting such a rush of interest. I have to do the physical shopping for envelopes and supplies and do the print run and the post office run, what the Irish call doing messages. I have to clear and read comments on the blogs of various kinds. I have to get names and addresses for intro packs and contacts off the Northwest Homeland blog, and that's a complicated thing. It takes a lot of time. I have to acknowledge receipt of financial contributions. Okay, most of those can be taken care of with a short canned email. But when most of your money comes in small donations from a lot of people, even short emails to acknowledge take a lot of time every day. Stocks of literature have to be maintained. This week, for example, I have to reprint at least a few hundred leaflets, if only for the intro packs for all those looky-loos. White books have to be ordered in a more timely fashion, obviously, and I have to order and maintain stocks of Northwest novels, especially Brigades and Freedom Sun, so that when it looks like I have a good mind on the hook, I can strike while the iron is hot. Also, and I will let the cat out of the bag at least this far, I am trying to write again. There's another project that I'm working on, and I'm actually trying to get in a little for real writing time every day, and that's difficult. If my replies to you by email and paper are seemingly short to the point of being rude and dismissive, then please bear in mind how many letters and emails I have to acknowledge every day. You write me 5 pages, and you're understandably, I suppose, pissed off because I email you back 2 lines. Well, multiply your letter by at least 5 or 6 per day along with all of the other stuff, and see what kind of time management formula you can come up with. There are two absolute deadlines that I must meet. Radio Free Northwest, up every week by Thursday, and Northwest Observer in the mail by the first of every month. If there's been one outstanding character trait of the white nationalist movement ever since I've been around, and that's quite a while now, it has been our complete cavalier inability to meet and maintain a regular deadline for our publications. Even Dr. Pierce wasn't able to do that. I have done so for 8 years in the case of Northwest Observer, and now 5 years in the case of Radio Free Northwest. Time and again, I've been told by readers and listeners that one of the things they find most impressive about the Northwest Front is our ability to meet and sustain a regular deadline and keep our stuff coming out on time. For a white nationalist group of any kind, that is incredible. Finally, every day, there's at least one drop everything. Some crisis or other, something or other that comes up and demands that I immediately drop everything and deal with whatever it is now, because only I can deal with it. Now, yes, I have some help in this area now, and they're good people, but almost all of them have to make a living as a first priority, and nowadays you don't do that in 40 hours per week. In fact, come to think of it, I don't know anybody who's employed full-time with benefits who works a 40-hour week anymore. Hell, you're really lucky if you can get off with 50 hours a week and a couple of hours transportation time to and from work every day. The 40-hour week seems to have vanished. Now, you can either get 60 hours a week with a few piddling benefits, or you can get in 3 jobs at 24 hours per week each so that they don't have to offer medical and can throw you away onto Obamacare. I've talked about my need for an assistant before. Obviously, it ain't happening. I'm crying for the moon, but I really, really need for some witch doctor or mad scientist to come up with a clone of me at the age of 29. Anyway, look, in the new year, the focus of this podcast is going to be changing, and I'm going to be talking about some things that many of you genuinely believe I shouldn't be talking about in public, and which will probably make you extremely uncomfortable. I'm sorry it's necessary. We have got to get this show on the road. Well, I'm running long now. Christmas is coming, and you're all swilling eggnog, or wrapping presents, or watching elf porn from the North Pole, and your minds are even farther away from racial stuff than they normally are. And so I won't get into all that, but I do want to apologize yet again to anyone over the past year who feels that I neglected them, or who believes that I am not taking them or their ideas or their offers of participation seriously. I want to apologize to those people who took the time to send me long, involved, elaborate emails and letters and received only the cyber equivalent of a monosyllabic grunt in response. Guys, I am really sorry. I do not devalue or hold your communications in contempt. I deeply appreciate the time you take to write them out, and I do read them, eventually. It's just that sometimes I don't answer them as I should. It's unavoidable, but it's also rude, and I will try to do better in the new year. But for now, our time's up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom. Well,